On the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is February 26th. It is a Monday.
What day is it?
It's March 2nd.
Posted. Sorry. I looked at the wrong date on my sheet. It says posted February 26th. I just looked at that. No, today is March 2nd. March 2nd. Today is March 2nd. Beautiful March. We'd pass things to this committee
that.
More easily.
Don't
that's for sure.
That.
Is there an emergency clause on this agenda?
We have a couple of things on the agenda today. We're going to have a very brief public hearing work session on Senate Bill 255 for the purposes of moving that bill out of this committee without recommendation. And then we will be having a public hearing on Senate Bill 478, which I imagine is the reason that most of you are here. So we're going to start out with the work session. And so I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 255.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 255 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 255 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion?
Can we get a reminder of what 255 actually covered? I saw the little tagline. I don't remember us having that in before us.
Chair Edwards, committee members, Senate Bill 255 has a no revenue and a fiscal statement issued on it that's essentially a hall pass just for the purpose of moving it to Ways and Means, and it raises the limit on fees for the annual registration of animal remedy, veterinary, biologic, or pharmaceutical from $75 to $150. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015.
So for the record, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that means that we ourselves have not had a public hearing on it, that
Correct.
We're just using this as a means to get it down to Ways and Means where they will conduct that and individuals will have an opportunity to participate at that time?
That's exactly correct. And I was in favor of doing the. I've been in favor on doing this with fees that are within the existing fee structure that seem to be just largely budgetary issues and are not attached to any new policy. Fee bills that have been attached to new policy discussions, we're wanting to hold on and have those policy discussions. So
just want to make sure that everyone that's listening to our fair weather stuff in the future know that we were not just quote unquote passing the buck, we're putting it where it needs to be.
Thank you for that clarification. Is there any other discussion? Okay, seeing no further discussion, are there any objections? Seeing no objections, so ordered. We will now close the work session on Senate Bill 255. And next up, we have a public hearing on Senate Bill 478. We'll open that public hearing now. And perhaps you could give us a little synopsis of what the bill does.
Edward, Senate Bill 478 would establish a list of high priority chemicals for children's health used in children's products, require manufacturers to provide notice of chemicals on the list, and requires manufacturers to remove or substitute the chemicals under certain circumstances.
Is Representative Kenny Geyer here?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative? I'm doing well. Could you please kick us off? This is a priority piece of legislation for me, and I've enjoyed working with you, Representative, on this legislation the last couple of years. And I'm hoping that we can see this through to passage, but we have a committee process and two chambers of the legislature to get through, and this is just the first public hearing. So would you be so kind and do the honor to kick us off?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer, State Representative for House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. And I am honored to co-chief sponsor this with you, Mr. Chair, the Toxic-Free Kids Act on behalf of Oregon families. This common sense bill will help protect Oregon's children from exposure to dangerous chemicals linked to serious developmental disorders and deadly diseases. Numerous Oregon businesses, community and environmental groups, such as an Oregon Environmental Council, and health organizations, including OMA, ONA, OHSU, Providence, Kaiser, Legacy Health Systems, MODA, Upstream Public Health, and Oregon Public Health Institute support this bill because scientific evidence links certain chemicals to an epidemic of chronic diseases and disorders. Research has shown that dangerous toxins, including arsenic, mercury, formaldehyde, phthalates, and BPA, are present in children's products and show up in children's bodies, human cord blood, breast milk, urine, and other bodily tissues. Toxic chemicals have been linked to cancer, asthma, Parkinson's disease, infertility and genetic damage, fetal and child development, learning disabilities, liver toxicity, and diabetes. Pediatricians are now diagnosing children as young as 5 with diabetes because hormone disruption is speeding up the development of the disease. The cost of environmentally attributable childhood diseases and disabilities in Oregon is estimated at least $1 billion per year. Oregon is transforming our health care system to improve coordinated care with a special focus on better managing the care of the 20% of the population who consumes 80% of the cost, often due to chronic diseases. We are also transforming our education system from birth to 20 to better coordinate support for children who are at risk due to health challenges, learning disabilities, ADD, and autism, among other factors. In addition to better coordinating our health, education, and human services for those who most need it, we must do all we can to prevent the occurrence of chronic diseases and disorders. Senate Bill 478 aims to do just that. Given how the FDA regulates the safety of food and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration regulates car seats for crash safety, many people are shocked to learn that companies are currently not required to disclose the presence of toxic chemicals in their products to either the health department or to the consumer. Oregon parents don't know when the teething ring they hand their infant, the rubber ducky they put in their toddler's bath, or even the car seat they use to keep their newborn safe contains chemicals that could make them sick. SB 478 will help protect our kids' health through the following steps. OHA will develop a list of 66 high-priority chemicals that pose the biggest threat to children's health. It will publish this list on its website with information about potential health impacts of exposure. Within 2 years of passage, the bill requires manufacturers of children's products with gross annual worldwide sales of $5 million or more to tell the Oregon Health Authority when their children's products contain any of these dangerous chemicals. These steps mirror the measures already passed by the Washington legislature with strong bipartisan support in 2008. Our bill intends to cover the same products and the same chemicals, making it easy for manufacturers to comply and allowing Oregon to build on the rulemaking and implementation in Washington. Our bill has two differences with the Washington program in terms of disclosure. Senate Bill 478 exempts manufacturers with global sales under $5 million a year. In Washington, they include all manufacturers of any size. And it redefines contaminants since the definition in Washington's law was vague and has caused problems. We are fortunate to have a representative from the Washington Department of Ecology here to share how her program works, and we're fortunate to be able to build on the lessons learned in Washington. Within 6 years of passage, it requires these manufacturers to phase out these toxins in products where the greatest exposure and harm can occur. These are products that go in the mouth, products that go in the skin or the hair, and products intended for children under 3. That is where the most damage can happen. Manufacturers can apply for a waiver if they can show that children are not exposed to the chemicals in the product. In other words, there's no leaching, or if there are no economically feasible alternatives on the market. The point of the bill is that if there are safer alternatives to toxic chemicals, large manufacturers should replace them, and we give them 6 years to do so. This bill is not only good for our kids, it is good for Oregon's economy, first by helping Oregon's emerging green chemistry entrepreneurs and encouraging innovation among manufacturers, including our homegrown ones, who sell to businesses in Oregon. Oregon universities and entrepreneurs are leading research and development of new safer alternatives to replace chemicals of concern. A joint OSU-U of O center received $20 million in federal funding for commercialization of innovative, safer chemicals for use by key industries in Oregon and beyond. Once they develop safer alternatives, manufacturers should use them. The bill will also help local retailers have confidence in the safety of the products they sell and may even increase sales in other states when consumers hear about the steps Oregon has taken to protect our children's safety. The bill will use state resources efficiently by providing clear authority and a streamlined process to track chemicals of concern. Clear guidelines and promoting safer alternatives through the hazard assessment will combat these dangers more efficiently than addressing emerging risks one at a time. This bill does not regulate chemicals and products that are already regulated by the federal government. In addition, food and food packaging is exempt from this bill. But when it comes to chemicals and other children's products, the federal government recognizes the need for greater protection, but has been slow to pass and implement laws. We cannot wait for the federal government to take action to protect Oregon's children. Like Washington, Maine, Minnesota, and California, states which have acted to protect their children, it is our responsibility to act in their best interest. This bill makes sense for Oregon's businesses, Oregon's parents, and most importantly, Oregon's children. We have the scientific knowledge to know which chemicals are dangerous to our children and the responsibility to protect our children from them. Senate Bill 478 will allow us to do just that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
I'm happy to answer some basic questions. I know there's a lot of people behind me, and I am chairing a committee at the same time. I have two vice chairs who are prepared to take over from me but are both new to the legislature.
Okay.
So,
we'll let you get back to your committee pretty quickly, but I would want...
I do have one Senator. Thank you, Representative, for your testimony. You mentioned that diabetes was due to the chemicals. Do you have reference to any specific studies?
We do, and we'd be happy to send you links.
Could you do that, please?
Yes.
And then the other one you said, a follow-up, please.
Yep.
OHA will develop. Aren't they just going to take the list from Washington, or are they going to add to it?
We are going to have, and again, we will have people who can testify in detail about this. We are starting with the Washington list, and there is a process in place where if there are chemicals that emerge, and there's a lot of scientific evidence to show that they're in the bloodstream, they're in the presence of products, they're of great concern, there is an on-ramp on that OHA can go through to introduce new products. It's not like they're going to all of a sudden be doing dozens, but there is a way for us to keep up with emerging science. And likewise, if there are products that all of a sudden are chemicals who are suddenly, oh, well, maybe this isn't as bad as we thought, it can be taken off as well. Or usually it's not, it's just a matter of these aren't even in our products anymore. So there is an on-ramp and an off-ramp for chemicals, but and in the case of Washington, out of the 66 chemicals, I believe there are about two that have been taken off and two that have been added back on during that period of time. It's an enormous amount of research. They started with 1,500 chemicals. I believe someone from Washington Department of Ecology is here, and did a lot of peer-reviewed research and narrowed it down to which are the 66 absolute worst, with lots of data behind it, with lots of different links that we can show you about what process they went through, anything specific about, like, the link between hormones and hormone disruptors and diabetes or BPA or any of those kinds of things. We're happy to send you those specific studies as well. Thank you for that question.
Thank you. I have most of that, but I didn't have anything on diabetes.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for your work on the legislation and kicking us off here today.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll see you. Okay, next I am going to call up, we're going to kind of go back and forth between opponents and proponents. We don't have an exact same number of proponents and opponents, so it'll be a little bit staggered at times. Bear with me. I'll try to just kind of go back and forth. So we're going to start with Sherry Malmstrom, Bethany Wolford. I apologize if I didn't say your name right. And I'll come back to that one. And then Andy Harris. And I know these are not all coordinated. Everybody's just signed up on the sheet, and I am picking people in just groups of threes. Next up will be a group of opponents, and then we'll go back to proponents. On deck will be, just so you know, and you can be getting ready, will be a Tim Shestek, Jennifer Gibbons, and Kevin Messner.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, Chair Edwards and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 478. My name is Sherry Malmstrom. I've been a public health nurse and specializing in child and maternal health for the last 30 years. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association in support of phasing out the use of high priority chemicals in children's products. I'm also a commissioner for women, and the Oregon Commission for Women is also supporting this bill with written testimony. The Oregon Nurses Association is proud to represent over 13,000 nurses. Nurses in Oregon make up the largest segment of Oregon's healthcare workforce and work in nearly every sort of setting that you can think of, from large hospitals to small clinics, from corrections to school-based and community-based public health. The nurses that I work with in Multnomah County provide care to some of the most vulnerable of residents. We help take care of pregnant women, new mothers, infants, and children. While limiting exposure to toxics is important to everyone, it's especially important to pregnant women and their infants and children. Frequently, the people we care for at the county have nowhere else to turn. They are struggling to make ends meet and to get by in this difficult economy. They're more likely to be in poor health and more likely to have children at risk of poor developmental outcomes. Many chemicals in children's products and toys can lead to serious health effects such as early puberty, heart disease, certain cancers, and reproductive disorders. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 133 million people in the United States, which is almost half of all Americans, are now living with chronic diseases and conditions, which accounts for 70% of deaths and 75% of U.S. healthcare costs. Reducing exposure to chemicals contributing to chronic diseases will benefit the health of the American public as well as the healthcare system. As a matter of public health, the state should act to ensure that no Oregonian unknowingly purchases a product that contains hazardous chemicals for their family or children, and to ensure that manufacturers are replacing these chemicals with more safe alternatives. As a public health nurse, as a parent, and a member of ONA, I support Senate Bill 478. This is an important step toward reducing exposure to toxic chemicals and improving the health of all Oregonians. Long term, this bill will help ensure that parents have one less thing to worry about. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I appreciate your time and consideration, and I urge you to support Senate Bill 478.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 478. My name is Bethany Wofford. I'm a parent from Portland, Oregon. My daughter Eleanor is in the front seat here, so sorry if she disrupts anything. I'm here today because it's really important to me to pass a bill like this so that we can have the knowledge and information that we need to make decisions as parents. When I was pregnant, I got sucked into what I call the dark rabbit hole on the internet of information about toxic products on the market for children, and I was just shocked to find out that so many children's products could be harmful to their health. When I was shopping for a crib, when I was shopping for a mattress for her crib, when I was shopping for a car seat, I just thought I had to worry about BPA and sippy cups, but I was wrong. And so I just felt like that was a really hard thing with all the other things that I needed to worry about being pregnant with my first child to add that to the list. And I think that it's really important that we help manufacturers to do the right thing and not put their profits in front of the safety of our children. So I had a story I wanted to share that actually just happened to me last week. Eleanor and I were shopping in a big box store that shall remain nameless, the one where you go in and right in front of you is this nice bright area of toys that all cost a dollar. So she goes up to this section and she's just so excited about everything, and she's at this phase where I can't take her shopping without her saying, "I need this, I need this." So she sees a little blue plastic Easter egg and she says, "I need that egg." And I looked at the egg and it's, you know, it's bright blue, it's full of glitter, it's full of goo, I don't know, you know, some kind of silly putty thing where you take it out. And I said, "Oh no, honey, you don't need that. That's gonna give you cancer." She's two, she doesn't understand yet. I can still make my little jokes. But so we put it back on the shelf and we started to make our way out, and this other woman walked by me and she had heard me say that, and she started laughing and she said, "You know, I was just trying on a pair of sunglasses And I took them off and I said, I think these are just made of cancer. And I put them back. And she just, you know, we both said, sort of had a laugh about it. And she was like, it's hard being a parent, isn't it? And I said, yes, it really is. And I think that's, you know, something to keep in mind here is that it is really hard to be a parent. We are always worried about what's the next thing to endanger our child. And whenever we have a chance to have more information to make those decisions, you know, I don't think this bill is overly restrictive on manufacturers. It's just helping parents have the information. If that egg had cost $3, but it had a sticker on it that said, this will not give your child cancer, I would have paid $3 for it. So I think that, you know, both this woman and I put our products back, and I think that manufacturers sometimes are looking at this the wrong way. Consumers are aware that products can harm us and harm our children, and we want that information so that we can be better informed. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Edwards, Chair Edwards, and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Andy Harris. I'm a physician. I'm an assistant professor at OHSU, where I direct the Global Health Center. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 478 for the Oregon Center for Christian Voices and also for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. So why is a Christian nonprofit organization advocating for this bill? Because we represent the voice of vulnerable and marginalized people whose voices are often not heard at the halls of Congress and in the state capitol. We advocate for economic and social justice. Young children, who are among the most vulnerable of our citizens, are unable to speak on their own behalf, and our purpose is to advocate for their health and their well-being. Children in our society live in a toxic soup of chemicals. Some of them are innocuous, but others cause cancer, asthma, learning and developmental disabilities. Toxics Free Kids Act directs the Oregon Health Authority to identify the most toxic of these chemicals, and it requires their replacement with safer alternatives. As a physician, it seems incredible that manufacturers knowingly put toxic chemicals in products intended for children. Such chemicals include arsenic, cadmium, mercury, phthalates, benzene, and formaldehyde, among the most toxic known substances. It's criminal. Benzene and formaldehyde are linked to cancer, endocrine disruption, and developmental delays. Formaldehyde is classified as a human carcinogen by the World Health Organization and is a probable human carcinogen by the Environmental Protection Agency. Formaldehyde has been found to be genotoxic, meaning that it can alter genes by causing chromosomal damage. It hardly takes a physician to tell you that formaldehyde and other toxic chemicals should not be put in pacifiers, shampoos, and plastic toys destined for the mouths of young children. SB 478 will identify the use of such toxics in various children's products, and it will require their replacement within 6 years for large manufacturers. Oregon Center for Christian Voices and Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility urge you to protect the health and safety of Oregon's most vulnerable population, our children, and vote for SB 478. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Yeah. Senator Olson.
Doctor, and I realize I have the list here, formaldehyde's really nasty stuff.
Right.
Is formaldehyde in vaccinations and vaccines?
Not to my knowledge.
It's not. Okay. To any one of the ladies, what do you think? Do you know in the bill that there's an exemption for companies that sell less than $5 million? You think that's good or bad?
Ideally, I think that it would be nice if nobody had to do this and we all did the right thing in the social justice sense, but I also understand that we need to, you know, consider small business and look at that as well, you know, so maybe that's an answer. I don't know.
Any other questions? Thank you all for being here and providing your testimony. Next, we're going to call up, I apologize if I don't get everybody's name perfect, Jim Shestick, Jennifer Gibbons, Kevin Messner. Or at least that's how I'm reading it.
Spot on. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tim Shestick. I'm with the American Chemistry Council, and we appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments today. Let me first just start off by saying that my member companies completely understand and are committed to ensuring that chemicals are manufactured, used, and managed in a safe and responsible manner. Consumers certainly deserve to have confidence that the products that they purchase are safe for their intended use. That is not a question that we have with this bill, nor do we have a question with the intent of the bill. Despite agreeing with Senator Edwards in terms of the intent of the bill, we have identified several policy issues that I'd like to touch on a couple of them today. Many of them were highlighted in a letter that the committee should have from a number of industry groups. Touching on a number of not just policy issues, but also some implementation challenges associated with the bill. So just to highlight two real fundamental policy questions and issues that we have that are currently identified in the bill as drafted. The bill appears to be based on this presumption that the presence of any identified chemical in a children's product means that the product is somehow harmful. And secondly, there's this assumption that the children's products on the market today contain identified chemicals that pose a risk to children, and those chemicals should be restricted. As we heard from the opening comments from one of the co-sponsors, the bill directs the Oregon Health Authority to create a list of chemicals of concern that are used in children's products, and for certain products requires that those chemicals be automatically phased out. I think it's important to note that compiling a list of chemicals is not the same as conducting an evaluation of how those chemicals are used, in what amounts, and whether their use poses a risk of exposure. For example, under the bill now, an identified chemical in a product that might be completely inaccessible to the consumer, just the mere presence of that chemical would automatically trigger reporting requirements and would automatically trigger potential substitution requirements based on the mere presence of that chemical without any sort of evaluation of how that chemical might be used, if there's any route of exposure whatsoever. The process of assessing chemical and product safety depends on a variety of factors, including how much the chemical ingredient is in the product, how the product is used, and what kind of exposure to the chemical typically occurs from using the product that may contain that chemical. These evaluation steps are missing from SB 478. As I mentioned, we have a responsibility to produce safe products, and we do so in accordance with current government standards and our own internal performance and product management programs. The bill, as it currently drafted, creates an Oregon-specific chemical management program that in some cases intersects and, in fact, duplicates expanded regulatory programs and data collection programs that are currently underway at the federal level. Oftentimes, we hear that the Federal Toxic Substance Control Act is flawed and does not provide adequate protection to consumers and does not adequately govern the safety of chemicals in commerce. I want to point out, and I think the other attachment that has been provided to the committee is a detailed spreadsheet of a variety of different regulations that are in place at the federal level. Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, Federal Hazardous Substances Act are just some of the examples of the regulatory scheme that governs products. So I just wanted to clarify that for the committee, that sometimes you'll hear that that TSCA is broken and needs to be reevaluated, and that's why programs like this one being proposed in Oregon is necessary. Just for the committee's own background, we encourage you to take a look at a variety of different regulations that are currently in place. Now, the final point I'd like to make is that many of the issues in our view that this bill seeks to address, that's reporting information about chemicals, prioritizing chemicals, assessment of chemicals, and the regulation of chemicals, are currently being addressed under new and expanded regulatory programs at US EPA. The federal government has recently released information on more than 7,600 chemicals that it has collected from manufacturers about their use of chemicals in industrial, commercial, and consumer product applications, including what manufacturers know about those uses of chemicals in children's products. EPA describes this information, and I quote from EPA, the most comprehensive source of basic screening-level exposure-related information on chemicals that is available. This information is updated every 4 years. EPA is also working to further inform chemical risk screening, assessment, and priority setting. As a result, has identified only 90 work plan chemicals that they are currently reviewing and assessing, and in fact, where warranted, may impose regulations on those chemicals. The federal government is also populating a new publicly available database called ChemView, which EPA describes as, I quote, its commitment to strengthen its chemicals management program by improving access to and the usefulness of chemical information. The goal is for people to easily get information they need to make safe chemical choices that can help businesses, individuals, and others make informed decisions about the chemicals they use. We think this is a good first step for states like Oregon to take a look at, understand what's happening at the federal government, leverage that information if necessary, instead of developing its own, what we would consider a very resource-intensive chemical regulatory program that is not grounded in good science. We are working at the federal level, and I think folks may know that we are in strong support of a bipartisan effort to strengthen the federal regulatory scheme associated with chemicals in commerce. We would encourage the state of Oregon and other states, frankly, to get behind that bipartisan effort so that there can be a uniform standard that helps industry and helps consumers instill additional confidence in the products that they buy. As the bill is currently drafted, we must respectfully oppose it this time. Appreciate the opportunity to make these comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and committee members. I'm Jennifer Gibbons with the Toy Industry Association. The Toy Industry Association represents toy manufacturers, distributors, and retailers throughout the U.S. We have over 700 members. In Oregon, there's approximately 400 toy industry companies, including 10 TIA members. Toy companies do understand the responsibility that we have in delivering happiness to children, and that is why safety is first and foremost in everything that we do. TIA does support appropriate and strong safety and chemical regulations. However, because safety is not a regional or local issue, we would like to see these regulations maintained at the federal level so that consumers can have confidence that no matter what state they may be purchasing their product in or whether they're purchasing it online, it is safe. We understand and we do support the desire to have the Federal Toxic Substances Control Act updated. As Tim just mentioned, there's a lot of discussion around TSCA reform as it relates to this issue. However, TSCA is not the only federal law which regulates the safety of toys and other children's products. There are actually six mandatory federal statutes and standards which regulate our product category. ASTM F963, which is commonly referred to as the U.S. Toy Safety Standard, was made mandatory under the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008, and that standard has been consistently evaluated and updated, including upcoming revisions for 2015. And this standard is comprehensive. It's a comprehensive standard under which toys are evaluated for all aspects of safety, including potential mechanical and physical hazards such as small parts, sharp edges, string length, sound level, and over 100 other requirements, as well as flammability, electrical, thermal, and chemical hazards, including things such as lead phthalates and other potential issues. Additionally, the toy and juvenile industries are the most heavily regulated industries under the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission's jurisdiction. The toy industry appreciates the goals of this bill, and we want the same thing, safety for children. We do have concerns, however, with the unique state-by-state approach to chemical and product regulation and specific concerns as it relates to Senate Bill 478. Senate Bill 478 lacks a safety-based decision framework. There is no amount of money that's too great to protect children, but increasing costs without increasing safety is a concern to industry. Additionally, Senate Bill 478 will create challenges for companies who sell their products in multiple U.S. states as well as internationally. The requirements in the language as currently drafted do not align with existing programs such as the Washington State Children's Products Act, and the definitions would also be inconsistent with what's being currently used in programs in Maine, Vermont, and California. Based on the inconsistencies in definitions, Senate Bill 478 creates a far more expansive program than what Washington State has in terms of reporting of chemicals and products. Companies would incur additional costs and expend additional resources to test and report on these same chemicals and the same products for two very similar programs. It is also unclear to us how the data sharing provisions that have been included in Senate Bill 478 could be implemented due to the inconsistency in how information would be reported. To the extent that consumers or the Oregon Health Authority desire additional information on product ingredients or the presence of certain chemicals in products, that information is publicly available via Washington State's online database. Senate Bill 478 also goes beyond the Washington State program by banning chemicals and therefore materials. The legislation would take the unprecedented step over time of mandating listed chemicals be replaced without any evaluation of whether further restrictions or bans are actually needed for those particular chemicals. Further, it would require manufacturers to conduct costly alternative material assessments based on a process that has yet to be determined. As you can imagine, that provision in itself is highly problematic as it will create uncertainty and added costs and may prohibit the sale of certain products in Oregon. Additionally, as Tim had mentioned, the products which contain a chemical that is only a listed chemical, which is only in an inaccessible component, which a child could never access, could be banned under this current language. We appreciate your consideration of our concerns. We all want safe products. The designers and manufacturers of toys are mothers and fathers and grandparents, aunts and uncles. I myself have two young children. We all want safe products, and I think we're all committed to that. But we hope that you will carefully consider and evaluate this legislation, as I think there are some unintended consequences. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Kevin Messner. I'm representing the Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers. And thank you, Chairman, committee members, for listening to our concerns. I think I just want to focus on one area. The Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers represent everything from white goods, laundry, refrigerators, dishwashers, to also portable products, coffee makers, blenders, electric toothbrushes, electric knives, vacuums, so the whole array of appliances. The appliance industry has a lot of long history in appliance standards and energy standards, and having a patchwork of different policies across the 50 states is not the appropriate path, in our opinion. The products that we make are global products. They're sold on North America, and many, and in all cases on energy efficiency, it's harmonized with Canada to create a policy and framework that consumers know are consistent and understand, and when they move from Canadian province to a U.S. state, it's not creating confusion. The earlier testimony by the one of the sponsors stated that this was the same products. And I'd just like to bring to the attention on our testimony, if you look at the definition of consumer children's products in the Washington and Vermont laws, identical, verbatim. You look at the one in this bill, it is not the same. It's not identical. So it's not the same products. If it is, then why not have the same exact words? If it's not, then let's be clear about it. So just wanted to bring that to attention, that this bill is creating a patchwork which just will further add to the confusion for the consumer, and we'd like to have something that respects that, so that if there is a policy decision to move forward on this, that the children's health and the parents' confusion does not enter into the fray, which you can tell by the over-labeling that occurs on appliances. Sometimes they end up looking like a NASCAR car. There's so many labels on it, you don't know which necessarily label does what. And so as an appliance consumer product, we like to have labels that mean something and that are consistent across. So we would urge you to, if the intent is to be consistent and have the same products in Washington and in Vermont, and all other areas, that you should look to try to make it consistent. So thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you each for being here. Senator Denver. Yeah,
thanks, Mr. Chair. Actually, just following up on your last point, urging us to be more like Washington, would the two other speakers agree that if we were just to move to Washington standard, that would be satisfactory for you? Washington, Vermont.
we may have different opinions.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Edward, or Senator Denbro, I think the fundamental issue that my companies have, my organization has to do with this provision in the bill that chemicals that are identified based on their mere presence are automatically on a ban or a path toward restriction, and we think that's inappropriate. That's not the case in Washington State, and I think if you look at the Washington State program, they're very clear in how they communicate that information in context to consumers, that the identified chemicals does not necessarily mean that those products are somehow harmful or they're violating any sort of safety standard. So that's the major component of concern that we have with the bills that's currently drafted.
If I could just follow up, are you having problems with the Washington system, since? I mean, I think your organization probably opposed it when it was first proposed. But what has history shown us?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Denbro, I think Mrs. Gibbons might have some or might have insight on that, just because her member companies are the ones mostly on the hook for reporting. My folks aren't. But just to follow up, that would be the main issue for us in terms of the difference between this bill and Washington State is there is a very significant component currently contained in this bill that we don't believe is grounded in good science.
I would say that our industry, as well as some other children's products industries, have, I think, experienced some challenges complying with Washington State, such as, whose responsibility within the supply chain is it to report and getting the information, and confusion amongst retailers and manufacturers. But despite that, I think that we are complying with Washington State as an industry, and certainly the moving towards a program that would be consistent with Washington State would be highly preferable if Oregon is going to move towards implementing its own law and not have this done at the federal level.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
Yeah. How about California? They have a pretty ambitious program down there too. So, are you having problems complying with their program? They cover a lot of people.
They do. California covers all consumer products. At this point, they have not chosen toys as a product category that they're regulating, but they're still in the very beginning stages of implementation.
Follow up and then, or excuse me. Do you have a follow-up?
Okay. I will, but
okay.
Give Olson.
Senator Olson.
From a chemical industry standpoint, we have this bill that wants to remove the chemical. I assume that there are really smart scientists out there that can find other products that can replace this, but the concern I have is those products that replace, will they be similar to and therefore have a chemical problem, or are we able to produce a chemical that causes no harm to humans?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, this concept of developing safer alternatives and green chemistry is not new to the chemical industry. I mean, my member companies are in the process of evaluating and innovating, examining competitor products, looking to innovate to ensure that the products are safe. And frankly, I think I'm able to say that our companies, if we didn't believe the products we were making are safe for their intended use, we wouldn't be making them.
I have a couple of questions, and I want to preface my questions by welcoming each of you to the committee. I in no way believe that any of you intentionally mean harm to kids, okay? So just so we're clear about that. We have a little bit different perspective on how these chemicals ought to be regulated and whether or not the presence, perhaps the presence of a chemical at what appears to be safe levels in one individual toy or product, if you're not regulating the chemical itself, then the presence of that, the presence of that in many toys and products in a child's environment may in fact be quite problematic. So that's the perspective that I'm starting from, but I understand that you're good people, and you have a different perspective. So I do want to know, though, back to this issue of federal regulation that you the issue that you brought up, Tim. So these 66 chemicals, how are they regulated federally and specifically how many of them are evaluated under one of the acts, like the Consumer Product Safety Act or something like that.
Mr. Chairman, I have to go back and through that list. I mean, they could be regulated under a variety of different statutes that are currently in place. I haven't done the side by side on that, but you know, we certainly could do that work. Some of those chemicals, I'm going to guess, are currently on the EPA's work plan program that I mentioned, where they have identified 90 chemicals going through this risk assessment process. So I'm happy to do that work, but and certainly get back that information to the committee.
That would be helpful. I've been told by folks that there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 10, and we're talking about that are currently regulated under the Consumer Product Safety Act. That is not information that I have seen with my own two eyes, so I'm prefacing that I've been told that. And so, if you have a different perspective or have different information, I would like to know that.
Well, we'll certainly work on that and get that back to you.
Okay. To the definition issue, is there a specific part of the definition, the difference in the definition between Oregon's proposed definition in Senate Bill 478 and Washington's that is particularly problematic?
Yeah, in my testimony highlights it specifically afterwards to reference it, but it's kitchen merchandise is in there and undefined, and that's not seen. I've never seen that term used before anywhere, but it's certainly not in the definition. So that's a new definition of expanded scope, well beyond what's in other state laws.
And so your concern is that while the intent of the legislation is to deal with things like plastic forks and spoons that little kids would use, you don't want it to pull in a blender or
a kitchen grinder
or whatever.
Right. I mean, kitchen merchandise could be a cooking timer. It could be a funnel. But it just says kitchen merchandise undefined.
Okay. Thank you. I'll leave it at that for now. Senator Prasansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how long has the federal government been working on this issue? How many years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Prasansky, I'm not following your question.
Well, what I'm hearing is you want us to defer to the federal government to come up with some type of uniformity that's going to be enacted around the country. Fair enough? I mean, that's...
Yes, sir.
Okay. So my understanding, because I've been on this committee for many years, they have been working on it. They've been working on it. They've been working on it. In other words, it's been years, and I see no action. I just hear talk. And that's why I think you continue to see state by state figuring out that the federal government's not doing it. We need to stand up for the people in our state and for the infants and the kids in our state. And so that's why I think we're pushing further down the road than we have in the past of trying to get something out. And I understand the desire from industry to have uniformity, but I don't see any action there. I mean, when is it going to be that we're going to have something that's going to be uniformed from the feds, from Congress? Let's face it. I mean, when have they got anything out, let alone something out that's so monumental as dealing with chemicals that go into children's clothing or into toys, et cetera?
I just wanted to add one point on, I think you're talking about TSCA reform. I don't know off the top of my head when the TSCA exists today. You're talking about the reform effort and might be something scheduled soon in the House floor. When Congress will act, I don't have no one has the crystal ball. But the CPSI, the Children's Products Safety Improvement Act, that was enacted just a few years ago. And so Congress did enact a law fairly recently. It depends on how you want to define fairly recently.
If I could also add to that, Chair and Senator, the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act was passed in 2008, and that actually made mandatory what was a voluntary industry standard that had been created by industry back in the 60s. However, it does not take an act of Congress to update that standard. All it takes is for that standard to be approved by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And so industry does go through, along with government officials and medical experts, and reviews problematic areas and regularly updates that standard. As I mentioned during my testimony, there's actually revisions coming out for an updated toy safety standard in 2015.
Anything else, Senator Przanski?
Why don't we go back to Senator Dembro, and I'll come back.
Senator Dembro.
Actually, you know, my question was related to the chair's, to Senator Przanski's. The process that's underway evaluating the new chemicals, what is the timeline for that? Do you have a sense? Those that are, you know, you had said that there are a number that are currently under review. Is this just an ongoing thing, or do we have a timeline by which, you know, under which they would fulfill that examination?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dembro, there's not a specific timeline for each of those individual chemicals. It is an ongoing process that EPA is undertaking in terms of its work plan assessment of those 90 chemicals. So it's an ongoing kind of revolving effort. There, you know, as that work is done and those assessments are done, they're going to be moving on to others, but there's no specific timeline for each of those, mm-hmm. at least to my knowledge.
So just looking back, how many have been examined in this way and either cleared or, you know, put on a prohibition list over the last year or two?
The work plan effort underway is relatively due. So the EPA has embarked on this under their existing TSCA authority, and it is our hope that at some point here in the relatively near future that Congress is going to act and provide EPA with additional authority to prioritize chemicals, identify safe use determinations for a variety of those chemicals, and really get to the heart of this issue that people seem to have a lack of confidence in the current regulatory scheme.
Yeah, I hear you.
I just wanted to add one thing to as we're talking about Congress. It's hard to I guess I wouldn't say it's not recommending to put faith in Congress acting as a history over the recent history, but one thing that might bring hope is that there is a bipartisan bill, and bipartisan bills are hard and few and far between on Congress right now. And so It may be worthwhile to hopefully, and I think we all agree, and maybe everyone in the room agrees, that if this TSCA reform could happen and could move this year, maybe we could see it move. And would it be worth waiting to see if this new Congress and President Obama, bipartisan, can come up with an agreement that would then impact the entire country? We might see some movement. I can't guarantee it, and who knows? I mean, you may not put the faith into weight, but it's possible, I'd say. And I wouldn't have said that last year.
I mean, I think we would all like a statewide standard if we could get one, if it was a good standard and mm-hmm. one that we could all feel, you know, had really, you know, was a rigorous analysis and you know, fully protected the safety of children. Mm-hmm. It may be a leap of faith, though, to you know, to hope for that being done in a timely manner.
Yeah. Senator Olson?
Yes. For the record, I pulled up all the chemicals from Washington on the list, and in answer to Senator Przanski, most of the chemicals that were on the list were inspected by the Dutch Inspectorate for Health Protection and Veterinary Public Health, and most of those exams were in 2005. So this seems to be reasonably new technology. Although for formaldehyde, for example, the US EPA Integrated Risk Information System has their last revision was 1991. So there has been examinations of some of these heavy metals, mercury, antimony, and stuff like that. But I think this technology that we're dealing with, because of the fact that we move so quickly, I think everything is rather new. And when one examines and looks at these things, I think everybody's caught off guard by all of this stuff. And I think the Dutch were the ones that actually got the ball rolling, because Washington followed the Dutch chemicals very closely.
Senator, who was it that you said did the inspection? Or could you say the first part of what you said?
Sure, the Dutch Inspectorate for Health Protection and Veterinary Public Health.
Dutch.
Dutch.
The Dutch.
D-U-T-C-H.
Okay.
Like Dutch Brothers.
Yeah, got it.
In other words, those people that live in the Netherlands, the Dutch. And I tried to pull up their report, and I can't read Dutch, so I didn't know where I was. But I would say in reviewing these chemicals on what I have printed, the technology is very new.
Okay. I would like to go back to Jennifer, what you said about mandating a ban. I don't know if that was your words, but you expressed concern about that, and I just wanted to make sure that I understand correctly, that I read the bill the same way. I'm looking at Section 5 of the bill. It says that, you know, after the third biennial reporting, so that's in year 6, if the chemical is present in a children's product that is mouthable, or it's a children's cosmetic, or made for, marketed for use by, or marketed to children under 3 years of age, then you would have some options. You'd have to get rid of it, do an alternatives assessment and substitute, or apply for a waiver if you could show that it is in fact safe, doesn't come in contact with the, you know, kid's skin, or what, I can't remember the exact standard, but, you know, there's a process in place. So it is those three categories, and it sounds like there are some alternatives. Yes, the burden would be shifted away from the consumer proving that it's toxic to the manufacturer proving that it's safe, but to me that it seems prudent to me. So that's a little bit different than, I think, than how you characterized it. I mean, you used a broader statement, but I just wanted to clarify that for the record, because there's a lot of interested people listening in right now.
Okay. I think when we're reading this section, mm-hmm. You know, we see it as listed chemicals immediately moving to being required to be removed or replaced. Without any further study of whether there's an exposure to the chemical in the product or whether the chemical warrants further restriction or ban. You know, later in the bill, there is a section that would require a report to the legislature on the various chemicals which had been reported and whether further action for restrictions or bans would be warranted, but that would happen after Section 5, as I'm reading the language. And having two kids who are both under the age of 3, you know, that section or subsection C applies to a lot of products. And, you know, the only other thing that I would just like to note related to Section 5 would be, you know, applying for the waiver would be a lot of information for manufacturers to put together, and it's unclear from this bill how OHA would, you know, one, have the resources to do evaluations of all these waivers that people may be submitting. It seems like that would be very costly and require a lot of resources, but also there would be a lot of uncertainty for manufacturers as to whether after they you know, used all their resources to provide this additional information, how OHA would be evaluating and approving or disapproving the waivers that they submit. So that uncertainty, I think, would be challenging and perhaps a high cost for OHA.
So you would, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, I'm just so I understand, you would prefer if the burden was on the state to undertake a study of each of the chemicals generally or in every product?
Well, I think if you look at the Washington State program, they've collected their data, and they're now analyzing what it means and what further restrictions may be warranted or necessary based on the data that they've collected thus far. And that this program would differ in that it would move straight from the chemicals been listed to it's immediately being required to be replaced if it's mouthable, a cosmetic, or marketed to children under
immediately in 6 years, which isn't quite immediately, but
over time, but 6 years.
Yes, I understand.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, it's not just reporting. It's a key difference between Washington and Oregon. Washington, just reporting. Oregon, we have a schedule and some criteria that would require a phase out or substitution or a waiver if you can prove that it's safe. So, anyway. Any other questions from, yeah.
Thanks,
Senator Tim. Brzozinski, Ben Olson.
Yeah, Tim, I think this would be for you since you're here with the American Chemistry Council. What tests are done by your affiliates before they put a chemical into a child's toy or something that's designated for use by a kid as to making sure it's safe?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Brzozinski, that's going to differ from all of the member companies. I mean, they have their own internal testing procedures. There is the other document I provide to the committee is this flow chart that shows when new chemicals are entering the marketplace, the process that US EPA goes to evaluate those. So there is a process in place for new chemical innovations to receive a review before they enter the marketplace. And if you don't have this flowchart, I'm happy to get that to you. But there is a process where we provide a pre-manufacturer notice to US EPA. And just some stats on that. EPA has reviewed since 1979 up to 2010 about 36,000 pre-manufacturer notices. So these are for new chemicals that are entering into the marketplace. So.
If I can follow up on that, it's my understanding those tests are actually done by the company in the sense of whoever's introducing the chemical to be used actually provides to the federal government whatever research they've paid for to be done. Is that correct?
Yeah, information is provided by the manufacturer to US EPA, and then they, through their process, develop profiles for how that chemical might be used. They go through an evaluation, computer modeling type process, and then they have the opportunity to ask for more information if they find there's a need to gather additional information about how that chemical might be used. They could determine that it might pose a potential risk in a certain application and then could impose a use restriction in certain applications, or it could essentially give it a green light, if you will, and it's confident that chemical and its environmental profile are safe for its intended use and would allow that product to be placed in the marketplace.
If I can follow up.
Yeah.
So it's my understanding from talking to others and from other hearings we've had on the same topic is that the federal government, the agency itself, doesn't do the testing. It's relying on what's provided to them, and then they make some decisions based on that information that they're not independently testing to substantiate whatever is claimed to be the results or the findings from the company that's introducing the chemical for possible use. Is that a fair statement?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Brzozinski, I think you have a situation where you have new chemicals that are in the marketplace, and then you have existing chemicals that may have preceded the EPA's pre-manufacturer notice program. So you have a situation, and I referred to it earlier in my earlier testimony about EPA going through this risk assessment process, identifying chemicals under its existing authority. And I think to the point that we're hopeful that Congress will actually enact a statute that provides EPA with expanded authority to maybe get at some of those questions that you're asking, so we can have this kind of uniform standard in place that would be implemented across the country. So I will get you some additional information beyond this flowchart so you have a better understanding of the process that US EPA goes through in terms of its pre-manufacturer notice and what it's doing with existing chemicals that are in Congress, or excuse me, in commerce.
Thank you. One other question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And this is, Kevin, I was listening to your testimony. I was actually looking at it as you were giving it, and I looked at the different items that are listed in Washington versus what's in the SB 478. And I also noted on the kitchen merchandise. I've looked at the bill real quick, and I can't do a word search on it right now. Do you remember where the term kitchen merchandise is actually used in the bill?
Yeah, in the if you look at the definition section for children's products.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
And in addition to the information that Senator Przanski requested, if you could, I would like some additional information about the criteria that that the EPA is using in that evaluation process. Is it just environmental criteria, or is it health criteria? Does it have to be, persistent in the environment and bioaccumulative and persistent in the environment, or are we talking about health as well, human health? So, please.
Mr. Chairman, could I just make maybe one comment? I was thinking back your last statement about the reporting versus non-reporting, and you're also asking about California, and maybe I'm conflating issues, but the California Green Chemistry Program, if versus, let's say, Washington reporting, if that's what you're thinking, California has some resources to apply to green chemistry, but even under that green chemistry, they are doing maximum 5 chemical product combinations in that first year. So it's a very and that still is an extremely resources intensive program. So that's there may be a difference versus reporting and versus what you're talking about reporting versus then going to the next step. In my mind, if that's kind of what where your mind was at, and I'm thinking right, it's a big difference between where the 4 current bill is in front of us with 66 possible things. They're just looking at product chemical combinations in California. So I just wanted to clarify that. It may or may not be what you were related to what you were thinking.
It wasn't, but I appreciate the additional information. Senator Olson, he's been waiting.
Just a very, very brief one. For the toy manufacturers, it says manufacturers are exempt from meeting the requirements if the children's products are at levels that are at or below allowable levels for children's products as established by the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008. Do you know if your chemicals are below those levels now? And would that exempt them from the criteria of this bill? It's on page 5, number 3 of section 5.
Well, all toys that would be sold in the U.S. would have to be compliant with the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008. Whichever of the 66 chemicals are currently included or would in the future be included under the CPSIA would be, my read of this section, those specific chemicals that would be exempt. But that would be relatively limited scope, I believe.
Thank you. Okay. Senator
Przanski. So, Kevin, I wanted to go back. There's a reason I wanted to find out where that kitchen merchandise was. I was trying to get the context of how it was in there.
Yep.
My reading under Section 2, Sub 3A, on line 21, it says children products means, and it continues, any of the following products that are made for, marketed for use by, or marketed to children under the age of 12 years of age. And then, as you said, it says kitchen merchandise. Some of the stuff that went back and forth here, I'd say like a blender and stuff like that, is probably not marketed for or intended for the use of a child under 12. Is there certain things? I know that in your testimony you talked about the funnel and the timer clock. Are there other things that you think are actually would be captured in that definition that would be kitchen merchandise?
So two things. One is, if the intent is supposed to be the same of Washington, then just encourage the committee to look at actually making it the right, because I'm not a lawyer. Somebody may be a lawyer, but there are very creative lawyers in the world. And then when the laws go over to the regulations, the regulators, and they could misconstrue it, and then you have lawsuits. And so our manufacturer's very engineering driven, and so they like certainty. So an undefined term, that's not in anywhere else, who knows? So the second point is, we don't know whether a lawyer would see an opportunity to sue if you put, let's say, a Mickey Mouse on a blender. Is that marketed and used for children? Is a humidifier that's marketed use for a child because there's Mickey Mouse on, even though the parent's going to use it? We had to deal with these through these issues through the Child Product Safety Improvement Act. But that's the definition. If you just put that on, it's unclear. And kitchen merchandise is undefined. What does it mean? So it's there's so many uncertainties, and it's just ripe for confusion.
Well, let me ask you this. The chair asked about your list. I'm looking at it again. As to calling out what Washington, Vermont has versus what SB 478 has. If we struck kitchen merchandise out, the other stuff that's listed for 478, even though it may not be the exact same words that are in those other two statutes, it seems like it covers everything else. Would your organization be more comfortable by us just striking out kitchen merchandise?
Yes, our testimony recommends that you strike that.
Any other questions for the panel? Thank you for being here. Thank you for answering questions and providing information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we are going to go to Joel Neig, Helen Anderson, and Lindsay Dahl. Yep. And next up after that will be Betsy Earls and Paul Cosgrove.
My kids used to chew on our refrigerator, so I'm kind of nervous about that.
Your lead-painted refrigerator.
Isn't somebody going to speak? The PA right there, Washington.
Yeah. Any of you are welcome to start.
All right, I'll start. Thank you, Chairman Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Joel Neig. Excuse me, I'm a professor at Oregon Health and Science University in the Department of Psychiatry. I'm a PhD clinical psychologist, and I conduct research on children's neurodevelopmental disorders, in particular ADHD and autism, and the causes of those disorders. And although OHSU has endorsed this bill, I want to make clear that I'm speaking on my own behalf here. I'm not speaking as an official representative of OHSU today. And so the particular issue I want to bring to your attention is that although there's been discussion here today about the risks to health in various ways, diabetes and cancer, that there's also risk to children's brain development in the literature for many of these chemicals, and that this affects children's behavior, emotional adjustment, learning, school success, and other problems that stem from development of the brain, and that in many cases brain development is more sensitive early in life than other organ systems or as sensitive. And so this adds to the stakes behind efforts to clarify the effects and protect children from these chemicals and list them. So I'm speaking in support of the bill from that perspective. So I'll make a handful of points here, some of which I will go over very briefly because they've already been made by other speakers, and others I will provide more detail when I think they're new. One point that comes from scientific research in this area is that when we start out studying a chemical, we consistently find not that the more we study it, the safer it is than we thought. We consistently find that the more we study it, the more risky it is than we thought. And the level of safe exposure continues to go down year by year, decade by decade for different chemicals as they're studied. As you're probably aware, only a handful of the many chemicals in use have been studied in this way by independent scientists. But this is a pattern that I've observed, and I see in the literature that is disturbing. Secondly, the chemicals on this list are active in many biological systems, giving them ample opportunity to affect brain development. I won't elaborate further on that point. A third point that I want to make that I think is very important given prior testimony is that there already is literature fairly easy to find, and I searched literature just quickly on this before coming down here, on particularly on phthalates, which is one of the areas here, but I didn't search every single chemical, but it's fairly easy to find studies that show that these chemicals do escape from consumer products fairly readily when they come in contact with human skin, not to mention infant mouth or ingestion. And so it is difficult for many of these chemicals to contain them inertly in a product. And I think there is considerable concern there that there may not be a need for further study of many of these chemicals. There may already be studies that show that, in fact, they can escape already from products. And I think it's very important to recognize that it's very difficult to prove that they won't escape. I think that's why it is important, I think, from a precautionary point of view in regard to these chemicals, that we know that if they do escape, they're very risky, and to assume that they won't seems rather imprudent to me, given the literature showing that they often do when tested in animals or in consumers. And this is done by looking at consumers' blood and urine and so on after they've used a product. And finally, I want to make a brief complaint from the point of view of a public health scientist. We spend time studying the effects of chemicals that have effects on children's psychiatric or brain development that are preventable when we could be spending our time finding cures for diseases. And so this does eat up public resources to figure out what these chemicals are doing. It's not benign in terms of where our health resources go, where our scientific resources go. A lot of effort and money from the public sector, from taxpayers, goes to studying the effects on development of these chemicals. So this is, obviously, that's a national-level issue in many respects, which has already been talked about, but it does further, in my view, support taking action that will stimulate forward progress here and stimulate, hopefully, eventually federal action, but although I am a pessimist on early action there, but I do think that's further justification. Finally, I'm a strong supporter of the reporting aspect of this bill. I'm happy to hear there hasn't been much objection to that so far. It's very hard to study what the risks are in Oregon because we don't always know, and although some of this is available in the Washington list, we don't know for Oregon what's being used, how frequently it's being sold, and so on. So information is good. It makes it possible to study, makes it possible to understand what's happening, and so I'm a strong supporter of the disclosure aspect, but I also believe there is justification for some of the requirements for action on some of these chemicals, given the literature already showing they escape from consumer products. And finally, given the volume of the scientific literature, my perspective on this bill, it's a very prudent, measured, proportional. This is not an extreme reaction or overreaction. The scientific literature is massive, and what you've got here is a fairly modest step, in my opinion, from looking at this literature. So I would characterize this as a modest step, not a drastic step in response to the literature. I'd be happy to provide source material, scientific studies for any of the things that I've asserted. I've reviewed, you know, literature for my assessment, but to keep your materials easy to digest, I've not attached those, but I'm happy to if folks want more information. So in conclusion, I support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My name is Helen Anderson, and I am talking to you from the trenches of baby product design and manufacturing. So I was actually on a call on my way here, hands-free, of course, about two new products that I'm bringing to market. So this is my purview. My extended introduction, my name is Helen Anderson. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm the founder and chief product designer at Milky's. We are a McMinnville-based company. That's where we were founded, and I manufacture products here in Oregon, and also I design and manufacture products in China and overseas in Taiwan as well. And I'd just like to go off script and address something that someone else said earlier about the cost and time of choosing a new material. I've done that, and it's literally you email your material guy at your factory and say, hey, I need a material that meets these specifications, and the material guy says, okay, we have it, and this is how much it's going to cost, and it's really pretty simple. It's done all the time. So I'm also a mother, and I fully support Senate Bill 478. As I said, Milky's is a global company. It started in McMinnville. We manufacture patented products, so those are products that I have developed and patented myself for breastfeeding mothers. Milky's products are sold throughout Oregon, nationwide, and exported to more than 35 countries. Milky's are also approved by the USDA and approved to be provided to the WIC program, which is a low-income federal, or it's a federal program for low-income pregnant women and mothers. And as a registered nurse with a focus on lactation education, I designed Milkies to support families with information and useful products that help mothers meet their breastfeeding goals. And my products are trusted by mothers and medical professionals all around the world to be practical, user-friendly, and safe. Milkies cares about the safety of materials that makes up our products. Everything we make is free of chemicals of concern like BPA and phthalates, and we've done rigorous testing to ensure zero chemical leaching. The impact of testing on our bottom line was small. It was simple, required only 3 product samples, and cost around $800. Furthermore, the test results do not expire, so testing is a one-time cost. Our material is FDA approved. However, many countries require a higher safety standard. For example, in order to export to Europe, Argentina, and Japan, we need to provide our distributors the independent third-party lab results showing our products did not contain BPA or other toxic chemicals. FDA safety standards are simply not high enough. The rest of the world knows that. And our international sellers required lab tests to prove that our products did not contain BPA and other chemicals. Babies can be exposed to toxic chemicals through their mother's milk and are especially vulnerable to the hazards of the exposures because they're still developing. There's no sense in allowing toxic chemicals and products that babies come in contact with. Infants in other countries are protected from these chemicals. It's time to show the same concern for the children here in Oregon. I also support Senate Bill 478 because it will make a big difference to small businesses like ours that have invested in developing safer products and avoiding hazardous chemicals. By requiring greater transparency in Oregon's marketplace and holding manufacturers responsible for phasing out hazardous chemicals of concern, this legislature will help other manufacturers be good actors like Milkies. Senate Bill 478 is an opportunity for Oregon to continue its strong leadership to protect human health by reducing exposure to toxic chemicals in our everyday lives. This is the time to act to protect the next generation of Oregonians. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 478 and thank the distinguished members of the committee for your consideration.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the Toxic Free Kids Act. My name is Lindsay Dahl. I'm the Director of Policy and Partnerships at Beauty Counter, an American skincare and cosmetics company. A few years ago, Beauty Counter's founder set out to see if it was possible to make products that would meet the performance demands of the American consumer without using toxic ingredients, all the while fully disclosing each and every ingredient we use. Our company believes that chemicals linked to harm have no place in the products that we put on our bodies every single day. In the 2 years since our company has launched, we've brought over 70 products to market. We've established retail partnerships with companies like J.Crew and attracted a major investment from one of the top global investment firms. We have a product line that ranges from children's shampoo to color cosmetics. We make nearly all of our products in the United States, and we'd be regulated under the proposed legislation. For context, I'd like to shed some light on the current regulatory landscape of our industry, something that's been talked a lot about today. The last time the federal government passed a law to regulate the cosmetics industry was in 1938. The global cosmetics industry is around $200 billion. The bill text overseeing this massive industry is a mere 1.5 pages long, and the few pieces of oversight that do exist are full of loopholes or are not adhered to. For example, some will say that ingredients are required to be listed on personal care product packaging, but what they won't tell you is that it's common practice for companies to selectively list ingredients. This is one of the reasons we believe the Oregon Health Authority needs to have the ability to require disclosure of chemicals of concern and should be able to enforce such a law. When Beauty Counter formulates a new product, it must meet a few key criteria. Does the product perform the way we want it to? Are the ingredients safe? And do our decisions make good business sense? We define safety much in the same way that Oregon proposes to define safe, using credible, independent science to evaluate a range of hazard endpoints like cancer, hormone disruption, and impacts to brain development. Safety isn't just about immediate reactions, it's about long-term health. Our ingredient selection process uses chemical hazard and alternatives assessment in addition to incorporating appropriate exposure data, all of which are similar in nature to the types of tools that are included under the proposed Toxic Free Kids Act. We use these tools to create safe and beautiful products, but we also use them because it will save our company money over the long term. By looking for the inherent hazards associated with particular ingredients, we stave off costly reformulations and ensure that any alternative ingredients that are used are actually safe. The Toxic Free Kids Act lists 66 chemicals of concern for children's health, and this is a really good starting point. None of these chemicals are a surprise to the business community. By point of comparison, Beauty Counter has a list of 1,500 ingredients that we will never use in our products, and that's just the first step of our rigorous ingredient selection process. From Beauty Counter's perspective, the Toxic Free Kids Act is common sense, practical, and an achievable approach for the state of Oregon to address chemicals of concern. You can play a much-needed leadership role in protecting children from harmful ingredients, and you have the opportunity to level the playing field for the business community. And you can help move the market towards safer products. Chair Edwards and committee members, thank you again for the opportunity to share Beauty Counter's perspective on Senate Bill 478.
Thank you, each of you. Questions? Senator Olson.
Doctor, you had mentioned that you studied these chemicals, and we spend a lot of money trying to determine good, bad, or otherwise. So I would ask you, if we put money into studying these chemicals, wouldn't it be wise just to keep these on a list so we don't have to keep studying other chemicals? Because you had said we'd like to put money into other examinations rather than doing this. So if we follow this bill and we remove chemicals from the list and add a new one, that would require you to spend money to examine this one. So my question is, have we just kept it there and not remove them from the list?
Well, we already know these are harmful. And so I guess the question is, do you want to substitute another chemical you don't know if it's harmful? You're right. If there's no burden of safety in those products, then they have to be studied again. But why continue unsafe chemicals when you don't know what's going to replace it that might be safer, especially when there are companies that are developing safer alternatives? However, I would prefer to see that there's some standard where they have to be safe in the first place, and especially for developing children. I think that would avoid the problem that we're both talking about.
Follow up. Would it surprise you to find out that the Children's Safe Product Act up in Washington, and a paper written by Barbara Morrissey, MS, and Jim White, PhD, stated this: in this report, DOH provides brief summaries of the toxicity and exposure information for each listed chemical. The summaries do not represent comprehensive reviews of the literature, but are meant to supply sufficient information to show that the chemicals meet the criteria of the law and ecology's selection process. DOH, Department of Health, was not asked to conduct health risk assessments or eliminate chemicals with evidence of toxicity only at high doses. The law did not require, nor did ecology's ranking criteria, include consideration of dose response information or evaluation of the amount of exposure likely to come from children's products when prioritizing chemicals for the list. As such, DOH and ecology do not assume the chemicals of the CSPA list to be hazards when present in children's products. Some chemicals may not be particularly accessible or may be present in concentrations unlikely to cause harm. Currently, agencies entrusted with protecting children's health lack adequate information about the use of chemicals and products, making it difficult to evaluate the potential for exposure and consequently the potential for harm. The information can be collected under the CSPA law. The information that can be collected under the CSPA law can help agencies and public gain a better understanding of what chemicals are in the products they use and help us evaluate whether or not there's a hazard, and if so, what could be done about it. So the people that collected the information for the Washington chemicals said that they didn't believe that there was a hazard at the level that the chemicals were in the toys.
And we do have somebody from the Washington Department of Ecology,
which is good.
I don't know their process. I do know that you can find studies in the literature that do show that very low levels do affect biological processes that could be harmful, and that those levels can leach out from products, at least in some instances that I've looked at. Again, I haven't looked at every single chemical myself. I do suspect that to do a comprehensive review of all the literature on all these chemicals would be hard, but it wouldn't be hard to find studies that do show the kinds of concerns that you're raising in terms of leaching and so on. But I can't speak to the Washington process because I'm not familiar with the details of that.
Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lindsay, this is, I think, really follow up on your testimony, reading through it and hearing toward the end where you're talking about the Toxic-Free Kids Act list of 66 chemicals of concern for the health is a good starting point. Then you can go on to say that Beauty Counter does not use 1,500 different ingredients. Are the 66 chemicals included within that list of 1,500?
Some of them are. I did an initial review of the list of 66, and 24 of which seem to, at least in my initial analysis, apply to the cosmetics and personal care industry. Some of the other chemicals listed are for different product categories.
So that's not in your bailiwick of...
Correct.
Okay. And how long did it take Beauty Counter to come up with the list of 1,500 ingredients that you would not use in your products?
It's a fluid list, so it's always changing based on a quarterly peer-reviewed literature. We do a review every single quarter of new research that's coming out around chemicals that are related to our industry. It actually wasn't that hard, though, because when you start to look at the international regulatory landscape, right, just by looking at the European Union to start, there's nearly 1,400 ingredients that have been banned from the cosmetics industry there. Then you look to Southeast Asia, you look at other authoritative bodies within the United States government and our academic partners that we partner with on our formulations as well to create that list of 1,500.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lindsay, I've been told that cosmetics, personal care products have existing labeling requirements. You touched on that very briefly, but then moved on.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to that. You said it's not that the labeling isn't that complete. So what does that mean? Does that mean that companies just don't label at all something that's clearly in their product, or are they labeling something that is an ingredient, but that ingredient is made of other ingredients that then at that secondary level aren't labeled?
It's both. So the problem is really widespread, and it's very common in the personal care industry. There's a couple ways that it can take place. The first of which that I touched on lightly is that a lot of companies are selectively listing ingredients. So what that means is that someone could buy aloe and use that in their product, which is really common in our industry. It could even be organic aloe, and it could be pre-preserved with a different type of preservative, say parabens, and only organic aloe is put on the label. So they're not listing, if it's bought pre-preserved, they're not putting that on the ingredient list, and that's a huge problem for consumers, because it doesn't mean that the market can just fix itself when consumers can actually make the right decisions. And unfortunately, a lot of times consumers are paying a premium for these products, and the companies aren't fully disclosing. So that's when we talk about Beauty Counter's dedication to radical transparency. It's really not that radical at all. It means we're doing what we're supposed to be under the few federal guidance that's outlined by the FDA.
So I want to follow up on this. So you're telling me that, and this is just an example, aloe could be in a product,
mm-hmm,
and the manufacturer has purchased aloe, but you're saying that it could already be preserved with parabens, but the federal regulatory framework just allows that to happen?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I wanted clarification on. I was just a little bit surprised by that. Senator Przanski?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what Lindsay's brought up, I mean, we've seen this before. I know the National Caucus of Environmental Legislators have had different seminars and work groups where they've actually shown where organics, and you think, well, it's organics, okay, but it's how it's prepared or how it's stored and what type of packaging it may come into the before it's actually used that could actually be the contamination.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any, Lindsay again, are there any labeling requirements? Because I've been told there are labeling requirements. Are there any labeling requirements for health risks of the products? I mean, it may say, XYZ chemical is in the product, which may or may not mean anything to a consumer if there's no disclosure that XYZ chemical may cause whatever,
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Lindsay, a question for you. Do you guys sell lipsticks?
We do.
Do they come in a box? And how do you get all the chemicals? There's lots of chemicals in there. How do you get them all on there? I'm just curious.
We disclose our ingredients several ways. First of all, we have it all on our website, and then we try to fit it on product packaging as much as we can, and both on the external packaging and sometimes, depending on the product, on the actual tube of lotion itself.
On a lipstick, too?
I actually am trying to picture.
Really deep.
No, we don't list it like on the actual tube of lipstick that I have in my Perspec there. We don't put it on the actual tube itself.
Just curious. And then follow up.
Yeah.
If you did list a chemical that you don't use, you said, but if there was a chemical like a paraben that was in there and you listed it, do you think your customer would know?
Absolutely. Consumers are really, really savvy these days, and they're asking really hard questions, and not everyone knows about this issue, and that's part of the reason that's really important, both for the state of Oregon to act as well as other state legislatures, to help make sure that even if people don't have access to this information, everyone has safe products. But it's amazing the questions that we get every single day from our clients that are asking really complicated questions, whether it's about preservatives or heavy metals and color cosmetics and a wide range of issues.
One follow-up to the doctor. Doctor, and I know this probably is way out of your area of expertise, on vaccinations. Do you know if there's formaldehyde in vaccinations?
I don't know. I don't think there is anymore. I think that that's been removed, but I don't know for sure. I'd have to study that. It's out of my area.
I won't read the whole thing, but I just pulled up the Food and Drug Administration, and the paragraph says, why is formaldehyde in some vaccines? So it's still there.
Let me make a comment on that, if I may, then.
Please.
When you look at vaccines, if there is formaldehyde in there, and I don't know if there is, vaccines have a positive purpose to save lives. And so you may justify a necessary preservative in something that's going to save your life otherwise. Where is the justification in a toy for a child? So I don't think it's an apples-to-apples comparison in terms of the type of product you're comparing.
Okay. Thank you each for being here and providing your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next, let's see. I said we're going to call up Betsy Earls and Paul Cosgrove, and then we're going to go to Carol Craigie and Susan Beal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the American Forest and Paper Association, here in opposition to Senate Bill 478. It is not a surprise to this committee, amongst most committees in this body, but more than most committees, the challenges of the paper and forest products industry in this state. But I'd like to point out why this bill presents a particular challenge to our industry from both a practical and a scientific concern. And to do that, I'd like to have you sort of visualize what happens in a paper plant in Oregon when we're manufacturing all sorts of paper products, some of which actually go into children's products, whether it be construction paper or the pads on the back of Band-Aids or the Kleenex in the box with the children's cartoon on it that is marketed for children. We used to run these plants with the residues from logging, and we used to do an awful lot of logging in this state. And as you well know, almost all these plants are now substantially, generally a majority, in some cases entirely, run with the supply of fiber coming from recycled paper products, which come to us from all over the country. To the extent we still have some chips from virgin logging operations, the waste from a logging operation, excuse me, from a lumber operation, those also come from not only Oregon, but from all over the country. So I'd like to point out where the practical and scientific problem is, and it has to do with the definitions in this bill. If you look on page 2, there's a definition of de minimis level, and there are two different definitions of de minimis. One is for an intentionally added chemical, and you've been mostly hearing about things like that, intentionally added ingredients to make a product. And with intentionally added chemicals, the limit of de minimis means it's the practical quantification limit. We don't intentionally add any chemicals of this kind to our products, so that doesn't apply to us, although I would second the comment of my predecessors that the fact that we don't have any variation or analysis of intentionally added at what level and at with what effect is problematic for many people. But if you look at B, that's the one of great concern to the paper industry. For a chemical that is a contaminant, a concentration of 100 parts per million. If you think of what comes in on recycled paper and, for that matter, chips, there are any number of things that can be in those products. And I think that most even of the proponents of this legislation would agree that a contaminant level of 100 parts per million is at the very least arbitrary. Some things at 100 parts per million are very, very deadly. Some things at 100 parts per million are perfectly fine. It depends on what it is. And we do lots of quality testing and assurances of our pulp to make sure that the product that goes into the paper products, which then are sold to the public, including the children's products, is safe. But if you have a lot of Doug fir chips in your process, you may very well have an issue with mercury because Doug fir loves mercury, and we have lots of mercury in our soil, especially in the South Willamette Valley. If you have a lot of paper products from heavily inked things, we spend a lot of time de-inking them so that we make sure what's left there is safe, but it may be, in some cases, over 100 parts per million of a particular chemical. We make the judgment call, as we think this bill should, between what level of concentration is a problem versus what level is not. And that's our greatest concern. 100 parts per million is relatively arbitrary. I remember in 2013 when I was talking to one of the representatives of one of the organizations that was promoting this bill, and I asked, why did you pick 100 parts per million? Don't you agree that, in fact, 1 part per million might be very dangerous of one thing, and 1,000 parts per million might not be for something else? I mean, obviously, there are ranges for different kinds of products and different kinds of chemicals and different kinds of ingredients. And the answer was, yes, that's true. It would be better to do that. It's just too expensive to get precise with that. We think that, in fact, when we're making decisions about important things like products for children, we ought to be more precise. 100 parts per million might be too high for some of these. It might be too low for others. So for that reason, we hope you will, at the very least, make some changes in making this bill more realistic from a scientific perspective and more practical from the perspective in an industry that is not intentionally adding anything, but of course has products that come into it that are could be subject to this de minimis level. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Betsy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Retail Council. And it's really representing the retail members of AOI that I'm before you for that. That's the reason that I'm before you today. The Retail Council is very concerned about Senate Bill 478 as it's currently written, because although the bill mainly regulates manufacturers, is that too close, of children's products, retailers do fall under that definition. In a couple of circumstances, if you look in the bill, you'll see that when a retailer's own brand name is affixed to the product, they become the manufacturer of record, or when the manufacturer of a product that a retailer sells doesn't have a presence in the United States, then the retailer becomes the de facto manufacturer again. And our members consistently make product safety, and especially for the children's products they sell, their very highest priority. And we certainly understand the need for strong and effective safety standards. But our position is that at this point, a national standard is, as you've already heard several times, something that is far more, far better for retailers that are selling multinationally or state to state be able to deal with. And we would encourage you to look in that direction, or at least in the direction of more consistency with other state laws than just imposing a new and kind of individual law in Oregon. Manufacturers that we purchase from are already performing rigorous safety assessments prior to the marketing of their children's products to us, and retailers are sourcing the products carefully to meet the highest safety standards that they can. But the fact remains that the retailer, when they're in charge of reporting what's in a product to the health authority under a bill like this one, is always going to have to rely on the manufacturer's representation, the manufacturer that they purchase from. So I would just ask you to keep that in mind. And compliance with the law, because it is significantly different from other states and because there are other laws that are already in place nationally, would represent a significant burden on retailers, especially those that operate nationally. So our members would prefer, as I said, a national standard. If you're looking at other states to try and get closer to, what I would suggest to you, or that we keep in mind as we move forward, is that it's not just a matter of putting, you know, the law in one state in place in this state or mirroring it, because there is kind of that complex and ongoing interaction between the rules and the law. And obviously anybody that's trying to maintain a compliance program is going to have to deal with both of those. So they're always changing. The rules will always be changing, probably more often than the law, and that's something that we need to figure out a way to deal with if we're going to go forward with trying to mirror any other state's law as we move forward with this one.
Thank you. Questions?
I have one.
Yeah, Mr.
Earlson. I agree with you, what you said, Ms. Earls, about the federal government should take this, but as we've all realized, that's going to be very difficult. I don't know if you know this, but Maine has only selected 49 chemicals out of the list of 66. Does this cause your manufacturers, your people that would actually move to oils through retailers, I guess, would this cause them problems, or would they just go by the Maine list that we have listed for them and be able to sell their products into Maine?
Oh, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, my understanding is that distributors for the West Coast and a place like Maine are probably going to be sending out two different types of product, but I think they would probably just be complying with the higher standard, which is, you know, what Oregon would be if we had 66 or 70 or whatever products in a case where they were sending the same product all over the country.
Paul, I have a couple of follow-up questions.
Sure.
So your paper manufacturers, are they producing the product that then goes to a third party, and then they, you know, they produce paper, okay? They don't produce coloring books, or maybe they do. I don't know. It's actually a question. So I'm wondering, is it your paper manufacturers that are regulated under this, or is it their customers that are regulated?
Mr. Chairman, I expect, without knowing precisely the correct answer, that it's probably both. Some of our companies are still vertically integrated, and mm-hmm. they make everything from, well, they actually grow the trees, they actually make lumber, they make the paper, the pulp, the paper, and they have consumer products that are marketed on the shelves.
Right.
Others are not. They are, in fact, then supplying somebody else to make the product. So I think I'm pretty safe to saying it's probably both.
Yeah. I think so, too, and it was, no, you're not supposed to ask a question that you don't already know the answer to. I do it all the time, and I was genuinely wondering.
And you're
exactly
not supposed to answer a question that you don't know the answer to.
So,
Mr.
It's an adage in this business anyway. The other question I have is, okay, so, I mean, just my first reaction when you said, there is mercury in Doug Fir chips, and therefore mercury in the paper that's going into the children's products, I would say, well, that's a problem then. I mean, you know, we could set up a process where we just eliminate the use of certain chemicals in kids' products altogether and let you prove that it's safe rather than the other way around. I mean, I think you're suggesting the other way around, that the burden of proof would be on the state. I'm wondering your reaction, because to me, you said mercury in Douglas Fir chips, and I'm thinking that's not okay for that mercury to be in kids' products.
Mr. Chairman, I think it goes back to my comment that it depends on the use of the, in this case, it's an element, but we'll call mm-hmm. it a chemical for shorthand, and maybe that's actually a correct scientific term for what an element is. It depends on how much and in what kind of product and how it's used. I can give you a non-paper example that I think is even more clear. There is a toothpaste available for marketing in this country, considered by the FDA as being one of the most effective ways to control the bacteria that causes plaque, that causes cavities. It has intentionally added one of the chemicals on the list of 66, and the FDA has approved that. That goes to prove the point that sometimes something in one level would be very harmful and another level might not be. To the extent there is mercury in Doug fir trip, that's why we have quality assurance and control mechanisms in our pulping operations, and we deal with that by making sure that it is not at a level that would be of harm for the use that pulp is going to be put. But it is at potentially at a level that's going to be different from the arbitrary 100 parts per million that's set forth in the statute or the proposed bill. And that's our concern. It's one level regardless of what the product is or the chemical is.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I think the two companies that come to mind right away, Kimberly-Clark and Procter & Gamble, both own forest lands, both make baby products, and both probably are dealing with what you talk of, the 100 parts per million. Do you think this would make it difficult for them to, I mean, they're not going to change their market strategies just to come to Oregon. Do you think it would make it difficult for them to change their market strategies for two states? I assume they do everything above board and safely. Everybody uses Huggies and Pampers, et cetera, et cetera. Would this bill impact their ability to do business in our state?
With respect to those two particular products, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I can't answer directly, and I don't know with respect to either of those two companies in particular. However, in general, I think that people who use paper products and manufacture consumer products of many kinds, both for adults and for children, and some of those are very personal products that, in fact, they are very sensitive to what the standards of the pulp is, and it make it very clear that those are safe. Now, whether that meets the arbitrary limit set by some state's bill, I don't know. With respect to what might be on the list now or might be on the list in the future, I don't know. But I know they spend a great deal of time and effort. Their brand is dependent on them spending a great deal of time and effort making sure they meet the standards and expectations of consumers.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We are going to call up Carol Craigie and Susan Beal. And Susan, I want to apologize. I should have called you up first. You had a child with you that is restless, and I understand, as a father myself, being a father myself.
You're in the doghouse.
Yeah, I'm totally in the doghouse.
Yeah. I appreciate it.
About halfway through, I thought, oh, man, I should have called her first.
Letting the woman with the two-year-old testify was really the gift, I think.
You go first.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate the thoughtfulness. And I just want to start by thanking you for letting me bring my children. This is actually the fifth year I've come to testify for a great multitude of bills focusing on toxic chemicals, most about children's products. And the fact that I can bring my children is an honor. So I appreciate that very much. My name is Susan Beal. I have two young children. I am glad to be able to submit my written testimony, but just to share a bit more off that script. I first came to activism around this issue when I was a new mother to a sick baby 6 years ago. And while she was in treatment at Dornbecker Children's Hospital in Portland, I started talking with her doctor about chemicals and products, and he was very encouraging about doing research, shared scientific information with me that he had access to, and I learned at the time, 2009, that there was a bill in the Oregon legislature addressing this, and wasn't able to travel to Salem that year, but called both my representatives and Senator Dingfelder, who is one of the main champions, to express my support. A year later, with a child in better health, I was able to come and testify in person. That was 2010. And my older daughter was with me when I was able to testify on behalf of that bill. So I've testified, I think in this room, I've got a picture of my son from 2011. I think this is my fourth year in this room, and I think right down the hall once. I've seen these bills die in committee. I've seen them die in the House and in the Senate. And I just want to thank you so much for continuing this work, because to parents and consumers like me, it is crucial. And hearing, you know, Dr. Nigg's testimony and several of the other medical professionals, my daughter's pediatrician wholeheartedly supports this bill and others like it. Her doctor at OHSU and the CDRC, who deals with children with all kinds of health issues and problems, has been a champion as well. And I'm here for love. I don't work in this industry. I'm not a politician. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a lobbyist. I just want better laws, not just for my two children, but for every child in the state. And as Dr. Nigg said very eloquently, this is a very modest step. This isn't asking our industries to do much. I've heard the American Chemistry Council comments and the toy industry and the paper industry, and I haven't heard the perfume industry yet this year, but they all have reasoning behind opposing it. And I understand that business is business, but this is the most innovative country in the world, and we deserve better products, the best that we can get, and especially when our younger children are the consumers. I think anyone who sat near me and my new friend and her two-year-old saw the toys and items that get you through between half an hour and 2 hours with young children in a room. Every single one of those things, I'm making my best guess about the healthfulness. Anything that is made for children, they deserve our highest standards. I've heard the discussion of the Safe Chemicals Act in TSCA, and just as a constituent of Senators Merkley and Wyden in the United States Senate, I've had long conversations with their staffers, just as a mother and one of their voters, asking them to support this important bipartisan effort. It has gone, I'll just say, it hasn't made much progress, particularly since Senator Lautenberg passed away, and requesting a federal intervention or in place of the states, I think at this point is just, we're going to grow old and die before those bills move at the pace that our children deserve. So I truly appreciate the work that goes into this, the testimony that came before mine, and I just want to add one more voice as someone who is not earning a paycheck to be here testifying. In fact, just had to activate my friend's, hi, my friend's plan B to pick up my daughter from her after-school art program back in Portland, because I'm not going to make it in time. We all do the best we can, but giving us the laws that we deserve and our kids deserve is just, it's such an imperative, and I'll be here next year if it comes to that, but I'm hoping that five times is the charm, and that the next time I come to Salem, it will be to celebrate this bill being signed into law. Thank you so very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Susan. And what's your child's name?
This is Everett.
Everett?
I actually found a picture of him this morning, actually, I think, sitting in that chair.
In that chair.
Yeah.
Oh, there
at 4
he is.
Months.
A little bit younger. Well, welcome, Everett, to the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Carol Craigie. I work at Department of Ecology, and one of my tasks is to implement the Children's Safe Products Act, which was passed in 2008. That bill did two things. It limited the amount of lead, cadmium, and phthalates that could be present in children's products, and then it required that manufacturers of children's products report on their use of those of chemicals of high concern for children. And the important piece of that is that the standards piece were largely, not completely, but largely preempted by the passage of the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, which you've heard about already. But that preemption did not impact the reporting requirement. So ecology's first chore was to figure out what would constitute a chemical of high concern for children, and that was a pretty big task. We built entirely on what other people had already done. We didn't try to reinvent the wheel. We really looked at the literature and what other jurisdictions had already done. And then we began a consultation with the Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit at the University of Washington, which are toxicologists and pediatricians, to help us focus on children's chemicals that are going to be important in children's health. So we didn't include every endpoint that might be out there. We really focused on what was important for children. And then we went to the literature to see what we could find out about exposure. So what we ended up with was 66 chemicals. those chemicals are all either in children's products, largely from the Dutch studies, or they're in people from biomonitoring studies done by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or they are persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic, which are chemicals we have on a different list in our state. So it's a pretty robust list, I think. Reporting began in 2012, so we've done three rounds of reporting. We've had 449 companies register to report and slightly less than 25,000 reports, so a lot of interest. And we have had reports on all 66 chemicals. In order to manage all of that, we created a public-facing database, which you can go to and look at what's been reported. We also figured out that in order to assure compliance, one of the things we needed to do was test products. And so we've also done quite a bit of product testing, and I'm going to just use a couple of little show and tell here to just sort of show you what we've done. This is a little tiny little baby shoe. I'm pretty sure that the person who can fit into this shoe can't walk, but they can fit their foot into their mouth, which I can do, but only metaphorically. So this little, the bottom of this shoe is 44% phthalates. So it's 440,000 parts per million phthalates, just one phthalate. And this little piece is like 18,000 of a different phthalate. So we worked with the company, because this is not a toy, so it's not regulated by the federal government. And we worked with them. They took it off the shelves, and we were able to, they reformulated essentially. They were able to make this little shoe without phthalates. This one is a little sheriff's badge. This has 400 parts per million lead in it. This one is preempted. It is a toy, and so we are preempted from doing anything about it. So we gave it to the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and I am sorry to say that we have not been able to determine if they did anything about it. They have a database, and it goes there. So, but we were able to find it. We've done quite a bit of product testing, and we do have a public face to our database that houses the information on products we've tested as well as what is reported to us. So we now have enough information that we've started to dive into it a little more deeply. Our intention is to figure out where safer alternatives might be warranted. And once we know where those chemicals are, so this list gives us the first step to knowing where these chemicals are. We can start to figure out if additional restrictions are needed. But our law is a disclosure law, and we do not have the authority to do anything about whatever it is we find out. So our legislature is now considering a number of bills that would provide some of that authority, similar to what is being requested here. Recognizing the importance of alternatives assessment, including hazard assessment, and these are important tools that we need because, to me anyway, the most important piece of these types of pieces of legislation, which we don't quite have yet, is some kind of ability to prevent that regrettable substitute so that we can move towards safer products and know they're going towards a safer direction. Oregon and Washington worked with six other states to develop guidance on how to do an alternatives assessment, and I think those tools are now ready. The National Academies of Science followed what the states did, and so I think it's important that the states use those tools. It helps reduce that patchwork that you heard about of state regulations. Just one final comment is I see in the bill that you're considering that there's a data sharing opportunity, and we look forward to a discussion on that should this bill pass. I'm happy to answer any of the questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah, Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Do you have any insight as to what it costs to do your testing?
In terms of?
Like if you have a product like those, that little bitty cute little thing right there, that's
shoe.
So cool. If you have that come in, what does it cost to run a test on it, and how do you do it? Do you have laboratories, or do you send it out?
We have, it depends on what chemical we're looking for. We have a screening tool that we can use for metals like lead, and we're getting one that we can use to screen for phthalates. Other than that, we have a lab internal to our agency, so we can send environmental samples there. They cannot always do everything we want them to do in terms of the 66 chemicals on the list. So I do have a unit cost, kind of, because it really depends on whether or not there's a method, whether or not our lab can do it in-house, or whether they have to contract out, because sometimes they do. I'd be happy to get you some general information that we use about costing out what product testing.
Could you please? It would be sure. Kind of interesting, because how many thousands of products do you have to deal with?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer off the top of my head.
Let me try to narrow it down then. Do you test every toy on the market?
No. Gosh, no.
Okay.
So what we've been doing is we set out projects. So right now we have just embarked on a project that's aimed at clothing. And so we do a literature search. We write a quality assurance plan that tells us about how many tests we can do. We go out and purchase the product, and then we bring it back and test it. But we're not testing for all 66. We're testing for products we think are likely to be in there. So we knew this was likely to contain phthalates. We didn't test it for formaldehyde.
How did you know that?
Because of the nature of this plastic is made flexible, and that's what you use for the phthalates for. So,
when you put together a project, do you budget a number for that?
Yes. We have an appropriation from our legislature to do product testing, so within that scope.
How much is that appropriation, do you know?
$600,000.
That's all?
Yeah. So we are circumspect about what we test. I mean, we really we look at the data we've collected and what the literature says, and then do our testing. It's largely for compliance. And we have found, I will say, first and foremost, a conclusion we've reached is most people comply, and they certainly want to comply. But then you find these, and lack of compliance also.
Do you think a consistency in the law throughout the four states that are five states that have it now would be appropriate, so that we all kind of played this same game? Or because we talked about the list, and if we all do things differently, the list becomes insignificant in the fact that we're not doing things the same way.
Well, I think it's kind of an evolving field. A lot of what we're learning here is learning, so you have to kind of adjust when you figure something out. Like, we figured out that our definition of contaminant may very well be too broad, and so because we're getting a lot of reports on contaminant, and we can't quite tell, well, why is it a contaminant? I mean, is it sloppy manufacturing, or it really is just a trace level? So that's something that we may look at when we try to revise our list, and our current plan is to do that in 2017. So I'm not sure I think the list automatically have to be the same, because I think there's new information all the time coming up. The basic process of trying to replace chemicals of concern with safer substitutes, and being consistent in that, and being consistent with how we look at it, like through alternative assessment, I think are what I hope we will get to.
Follow up?
Yeah.
When we talked about your laboratory, and it's an internal lab, you have chemists and all that stuff, and they're doing these tests fine. When you say safer substitutes, when we change a product, how do we know that what we got is safe? It's because we're in this mess right now because we have products that have been developed, and then we look to see how do we make them safer, but do we know that if we go from BPA to BPH that H is safer than A? And we found out in that case it isn't.
Yeah. A challenging question, clearly. I think the alternatives assessment guidance that the states worked on, that I'm most familiar with, and Oregon was one of the states that worked on it, it lays out a way to assess hazard. So you're going to look at the toxicity of each chemical and a way to compare it to each other. But it also, an alternatives assessment also has to consider the performance of the chemical, the cost of it, whether the substitute is available, and you have to be able to look at it in its entirety, and you have to be able to consider exposure in that whole things. It's not a risk assessment, but it's a different way. It's answering a different question. The way I usually put it is a risk assessment is really asking how much of this chemical can I put in here before I'm going to cause harm, whereas an alternatives assessment is really saying how little. What's the least amount of this harmful thing I can put in to get whatever quality I want out? Well, that's how I think about it anyway.
Hold on just a second. Do you have a question for Susan?
No.
You can. Thank I don't you. Have a question either, so when you can go. I know you have a child. And
thank you.
So.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
The question I would ask then is, let me see if I can remember exactly what it was. Yes. Are there levels of chemicals that are safe, even if they're in the product, such as I mentioned the fact that there's formaldehyde in vaccines? FDA says there is. Are there levels of these 66 chemicals that can be in a product, but yet still have that product be safe to use? Because I commented from your Department of Health,
and
I just wondered if that in fact is true, or they all need to go.
I think there are products that are safe to use, and that the chemical being present in it solely by itself is not an indication that the product itself is unsafe. This product, not so hot.
Yeah.
But there's plenty of products out there that are perfectly safe to use as intended. I tend to think about, and I'm just talking as Carol now, working on toxics policy, not Department of Ecology, so I'll just distance myself a little bit. But when we look at chemicals that are in products, it's difficult, and I don't think we have the technology or the tools to really look at synergistic effects and how long exposures or exposure from a multitude of things, how that really works. And so our stance in our state has been to try to figure out a way to, if something is toxic, to figure out if something less toxic could be used. Still have to consider exposure, still have to consider cost and performance, can't ignore those things. It's critical to making the product. But if I could make this without phthalates, you know, even if it didn't have 44% in it, I would still want to not use the phthalate if, in fact, I could find something that was safer. And that didn't make this really stiff, but still made it flexible. So it's a different way to look at the question, I think. And I think that's where the states have largely been.
Well, I think one of the good things about this bill is the fact that it does make companies become good stewards, and they look at what chemicals do I need to avoid and stay away from, how can I fit it into the product safety but yet still get the product to be usable. That's why I asked you about the question of, is there an acceptable level of chemical in products that we can use but still have them be on the list?
I don't know that our department or our Department of Health could figure that out. That's why we've tried a different approach. That's a very challenging question to answer.
Follow, because you probably know that California has an enormous list of products, including marijuana, which they said is cancer-forming. It was on the list. I was surprised to see that on there. But I didn't see this type of law that they had. They just had a complete list of the carcinogens and stuff like that. But I didn't see the mandate. Do they have that mandate that some of these?
Well, I'm no expert on the way California works, but my understanding is they are choosing, as you heard earlier, a chemical product combination. So one was a flame retardant in a baby changing pad. Don't need it. You know, so that is a requirement then for, I think what happens is that triggers an alternatives assessment by manufacturers of those products to come back and say, here's the safer alternatives for this particular product chemical combination. And then I think the state has then ability to do something like ban it or restrict it, or they have a lot of choices to do under their green chemistry law. It's a different structure than what you're considering, and it's different from Washington, which is just disclosure at this point.
One last question, very short. You probably heard me mention Kimberly-Clark and Procter & Gamble. Do you do any tests on their diapers, on their Huggies or their Pampers, to see if there's any toxic chemicals?
I'm not sure if I think we have, but I don't, we've 25,000, well, no, we haven't, that's what's reported. I don't remember if we have or not.
Okay.
So I could look, but it's in our database, which does have a public face, although I'm not sure all the data is in there. So
if you happen to stumble upon it in the next week or so, could you send it down? I'd just be curious.
Sure. I could do that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Sure.
Thank you for being here.
Sure.
Okay, we've got one final panel. Thank you, committee members and members in the audience for being patient with us. We ended up with a lot more questions and answers and back and forth than I had anticipated. Final panel, Josie Canistra, I think you have two students with you. Babe Taylor, Emma, that's what I have written down here.
They're going, uh-oh.
Come on up. And then Angela Crowley-Cook. I promise that Senator Olson is going to be nice.
Save the best for last.
Okay.
Go ahead.
My name is Josie Canistra. I'm an eighth grader at Sunnyside Environmental School in Portland. I'm one of five other students from my school who've collected 161 signatures from children at our school in support of Senate Bill 478, the Toxic Free Kids Act. We learned about this bill from a mom of a kindergartner who's concerned about the effects of toxic chemicals in children's toys and brought it to the attention of our principal. She passed it on to our teachers. After reading more about the issue of chemicals in baby and child products, and upon hearing that chemical ingredients are used in toys such as pacifiers, balls, and other plastic products, it raised our concern about it more. Their small bodies have not built up strong systems to help them stay healthy. These chemicals just hurt them more. Children and infants are more affected by exposure to toxic chemicals than adults. When children are exposed to these chemicals at a young age, they may suffer illness later in life. Some of these toxic chemicals have been linked to cancer, infertility, and obesity. Examples of these chemicals in children's products include formaldehyde and arsenic in children's clothes. Formaldehyde and arsenic are both chemicals linked to cancer. In the United States, our healthcare system is burdened by childhood health problems linked to toxic chemical exposures. The costs of lead poisoning, asthma, cancer, and developmental disabilities alone add up to more than $54 billion. A lot of the chemical safety levels are based off of 30 or 35-year-old men and women. Then these chemicals are put into children and babies. They start in shampoos and clothes and absorb through skin. Children are uniquely vulnerable to chemicals. I believe in protecting kids' health, mine, my four siblings, and all other children. I know that kids are harmed by the chemicals and products they use, and they should know too. Parents and kids deserve a chance to make good choices to be healthy. We have choices about how much to exercise, what we eat, how often we brush our teeth, but we don't know that the products we use have dangerous chemicals in them. We can't make better choices for ourselves. Oregon should make it possible for all kids and parents to make healthy choices.
Thank you for your testimony. Would you like to say anything?
I didn't get to write anything. Yes.
Need to put the microphone.
I didn't even know I was going to come here this morning.
Here's what we'll do.
I've got a question for you then.
You can forever be on the record in the Oregon legislature on the public record.
Yes.
Say your name and whether you support the bill or you don't support the bill.
My name is Babe Taylor, and I really support the bill.
Okay. And how about you?
My name is Emma Manning, and I support the bill also.
All right. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add? You don't have to.
Nope.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Very informative. Very good job. Thank you.
Thank you all three for being here and for sharing your testimony with us. Angela Crowley-Cook.
Now I can ask the tough ones.
It's a really tough act to follow. Angela Crowley-Cook, I'm from the Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council strongly supports SB 478. It's smart public policy that provides OHA with the necessary tools to effectively protect children's health by reducing exposures to hazardous substances that children encounter every day. So we've talked throughout this long hearing about a lot of details and specifics of the bill, but I want to take us back and end sort of from the 10,000-foot perspective. There is sound scientific evidence showing that each of the chemicals on the list are of high concern to children's health. When Washington State evaluated that list of 66 chemicals, each of them are found to have one or more of the following properties. They harm the normal development of a fetus or a child or cause other developmental toxicity, cause cancer, genetic damage, or reproductive harm, disrupt the endocrine, the hormonal system, damage the nervous system, immune system, or organs that cause other systemic toxicity. They're persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic, or very persistent and very bioaccumulative. Now, we've also heard that manufacturers don't have to use these toxic chemicals. Many safer alternatives are already on the market. So knowing this, and that children are more vulnerable, as you just heard, to toxic exposures than adults, it's time to take these common sense steps for safer conditions. I want to bring us back for a moment to 2013. SB 478 is nearly the same as HB 3162 that passed the House of Representatives in 2013 with bipartisan support. There are only two differences from that bill. One is the list, which is now 66 chemicals to streamline with Washington's list, and the additional technical fix in the definition system section about contaminants. The 2013 bill was crafted by Representative Kenny Guyer and Representative Conger, is narrow in scope, and includes common sense provisions for small and large businesses alike. In particular, I want to remind the committee of the waiver process. If a company cannot technically or financially replace a chemical, they can apply for a waiver and be exempt from the phase-out component. In addition, we heard some talk about there's not enough evaluation of these chemicals, but remember that if a company feels the chemical is not actually leaching out of the product and that there is an exposure to the chemical, they can also apply for a waiver and be exempt from the phase out. The bill is also reasonable when looking at other states. We've heard about what other states do, and I want to repeat what Representative Kenny Guyer said at the beginning, that the disclosure piece of the bill will be streamlined with Washington, and the intent is to include the same products in this bill as are required in the Washington law. I also want to mention a couple other things that we heard discussed. We just heard a representative from Washington's Department of Ecology talk about product testing. And I just want to note that product testing for compliance is not required by the current bill in front of you, but it is optional for the department to do, for the health authority. Lastly, we heard some former witnesses talk about other federal laws and regulations that their products comply with. And one was mentioned in particular, the Consumer Safe Product Improvement Act, which is a new federal, relatively new federal law. That law only regulates seven chemicals: lead, and then six chemicals called phthalates, different types of phthalates. So that's all we're talking about, is just those seven chemicals that are regulated at a federal level when it comes to consumer products at these lower levels of exposure. One of the prior witnesses mentioned toothpaste has one of these chemicals. That's kind of a perfect example. A lot of these chemicals are found in all sorts of consumer products because they're not regulated. So that's the goal of this bill, is to make sure parents don't have to become chemists in order to protect their kids, but that they can feel confident in the products they purchase, that they're safe for their children. So thank you very much, and that's why OEC supports Senate Bill 478.
Thank you.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Please.
So the question then is, why would you support a $5 million exemption so a company that does less than $5 million can pour their toxic chemicals into our state?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, thank you for the question. The reason is because I want safe products from everybody. I'd like to see the phase-out apply to all children's products, but we're starting small. This is a reasonable first step for Oregon to take. And really, when it comes to leading the way for R&D and looking at green chemistry and safer alternatives, it's the larger companies that are going to lead the way. They already have the R&D departments. We're not looking to, put a mom-and-pop shop that are making wooden trains in their garage out of business. The goal is to move the entire marketplace and have that R&D started so that we can have safer alternatives available for everyone.
Follow up.
But the mom and pop shop doesn't make the chemicals that go into the product. They just put the product together. They paint the train, and they buy those chemicals from somebody else. So the question is why would we exempt them if they're putting a toxic chemical onto a toy that thousands, perhaps millions of kids in Oregon would use?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. So the small business exemption is $5 million in worldwide sales or less, which is actually fairly small. I agree, Senator. It would be great if it were stronger, but we're taking a reasonable first step. The mom and pop in their garage, they don't have an R&D department in the living room that's looking at what are the alternatives we can use for this wooden train. So that's what I mean when we want the larger companies to really pave the way for looking at alternatives.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee members and folks in the hearing room, for hanging in there. It was a long hearing, 1.5 hour long, but I appreciate it. I think we aired out a lot of aspects. Aired out a lot of aspects of the bill and a lot of questions answered. So thank you. We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 478. And we have no other business for the day, so we are adjourned.